Chapter 12. Coffee. After I had drunk it, I looked ahead, and in the still streak of very bright pale orange light I saw the land profiled flatly, as if cut out of black paper and seeming to float on the water as light as cork. But the rising sun turned it into mere dark vapor, a doubtful, massive shadow trembling in the hot glare. The watch finished washing decks. I went below, and stopped at Mr. Burns' door. He could not bear to have it shut, but hesitated to speak to him till he moved his eyes. I gave him the news. Sighted Cape Lion at daylight. About 15 miles. He moved his lips then, but I heard no sound till I put my ear down, and caught the peevish comment, colon, this is crawling. ... no luck. Better luck than standing still, anyhow, I pointed out resignedly, and left him to whatever thoughts or fancies haunted his awful immobility. Later that morning, when relieved by my second officer, I threw myself on my couch, and for some 3 hours or so I really found oblivion. It was so perfect, that on waking up I wondered where I was. Then came the immense relief of the thought. On board my ship. At sea. At sea. Through the portholes I beheld an unruffled, sun-smitten horizon. The horizon of a windless day. But its spaciousness alone was enough to give me a sense of a fortunate escape, a momentary exaltation of freedom. I stepped out into the saloon with my heart lighter than it had been for days. Ransom was at the sideboard preparing to lay the table for the first sea dinner of the passage. He turned his head, and something in his eyes checked my modest elation. Instinctively I asked, colon, what is it now, not expecting in the least the answer I got. It was given with that sort of contained serenity which was characteristic of the man. I am afraid we haven't left all sickness behind us, sir. We haven't. What's the matter? He told me then that two of our men had been taken bad with fever in the night. One of them was burning, and the other was shivering, but he thought that it was pretty much the same thing. I thought so too. I felt shocked by the news. One burning, the other shivering, you say? No. We haven't left the sickness behind. Do they look very ill? Middling bad, sir. Ransom's eyes gazed steadily into mine. We exchanged smiles. Ransom's a little wistful, as usual, mine no doubt grim enough to correspond with my secret exasperation. I asked, was there any wind at all this morning? Can hardly say that, sir. We've moved all the time though. The land ahead seems a little nearer. That was it. A little nearer. Whereas if we had only had a little more wind, only a very little more, we might, we should, have been abreast of Lyon by this time, and increasing our distance from that contaminated shore. And it was not only the distance. It seemed to me that a stronger breeze would have blown away the contamination which clung to the ship. It obviously did cling to the ship. Two men. One burning, one shivering. I felt a distinct reluctance to go and look at them. What was the good? Poison is poison. Tropical fever is tropical fever. But that it should have stretched its claw after us over the sea seemed to me an extraordinary and unfair license. I could hardly believe that it could be anything worse than the last desperate pluck of the evil from which we were escaping into the clean breath of the sea. If only that breath had been a little stronger. However, there was the quinine against the fever. I went into the spare cabin, where the medicine chest was kept to prepare two doses. I opened it full of faith as a man opens a miraculous shrine. The upper part was inhabited by a collection of bottles, all square-shouldered, and as like each other as peas. Under that orderly array there were two drawers, stuffed as full of things as one could imagine: paper packages, bandages, cardboard boxes officially labeled. The lower of the two, in one of its compartments, contained our provision of quinine. There were five bottles, all round and all of a size. One was about a third full. The other four remained still wrapped up in paper and sealed. But I did not expect to see an envelope lying on top of them. A square envelope, belonging, in fact, to the ship's stationery. It lay so that I could see it was not close down, and on picking it up and turning it over I perceived that it was addressed to myself. It contained a half sheet of notepaper, which I unfolded with a queer sense of dealing with the uncanny, but without any excitement as people meet and do extraordinary things in a dream. "My dear Captain," it began, but I ran to the signature. The writer was the doctor. The date was that of the day on which, returning from my visit to Mr. Burns in the hospital, I had found the excellent doctor waiting for me in the cabin, and when he told me that he had been putting in time inspecting the medicine chest for me. How bizarre! While expecting me to come in at any moment, he had been amusing himself by writing me a letter, and then as I came in had hastened to stuff it into the medicine chest drawer. A rather incredible proceeding. I turned to the text in wonder. In a large, hurried, but legible hand, the good, sympathetic man, for some reason, either of kindness or more likely impelled by the irresistible desire to express his opinion, with which he didn't want to damp my hopes before, was warning me not to put my trust in the beneficial effects of a change from land to sea. "Didn't want to add to your worries by discouraging your hopes," he wrote. "I'm afraid that, medically speaking, the end of your troubles is not yet." In short, he expected me to have to fight a probable return of tropical illness. Fortunately, I had a good provision of quinine. I should put my trust in that, and administer it steadily, when the ship's health would certainly improve. I crumpled up the letter, and rammed it into my pocket. Ransom carried off two big doses to the men forward. As to myself, I did not go on deck as yet. I went instead to the door of Mr. Burns' room, and gave him that news too. It was impossible to say the effect it had on him. At first I thought that he was speechless. His head lay sunk in the pillow. He moved his lips enough, however, to assure me that he was getting much stronger, a statement shockingly untrue on the face of it. That afternoon I took my watch as a matter of course. A great overheated stillness enveloped the ship and seemed to hold her motionless in a flaming ambience composed in two shades of blue. Faint, hot puffs eddied nervelessly from her sails. And yet she moved. She must have. For, as the sun was setting, we had drawn abreast of Cape Lion and dropped it behind us. An ominous retreating shadow in the last gleams of twilight. In the evening, under the crude glare of his lamp, Mr. Burns seemed to have come more to the surface of his bedding. It was as if a depressing hand had been lifted off him. He answered my few words by a comparatively long, connected speech. He asserted himself strongly. If he escaped, being smothered by this stagnant heat, he said, he was confident that in a very few days he would be able to come up on deck and help me. While he was speaking, I trembled lest this effort of energy should leave him lifeless before my eyes. But I cannot deny that there was something comforting in his willingness. I made a suitable reply, but pointed out to him that the only thing that could really help us was wind, a fair wind. He rolled his head impatiently on the pillow, and it was not comforting in the least to hear him begin to mutter crazily about the late captain, that old man buried in latitude 8D20, right in our way, ambushed at the entrance of the Gulf. "Are you still thinking of your late captain, Mr. Burns?" I said. "Imagine the dead feel no animosity against the living. They care nothing for them." "You don't know that one," he breathed out feebly. "No. I didn't know him, and he didn't know me. And so he can't have any grievance against me, anyway." "Yes. But there's all the rest of us on board," he insisted. I felt the inexplicable strength of common sense being insidiously menaced by this gruesome, by this insane, delusion. And I said, "You mustn't talk so much. You will tire yourself." "And there is the ship herself," he persisted in a whisper. "Now, not a word more," I said, stepping in and laying my hand on his cool forehead. It proved to me that this atrocious absurdity was rooted in the man himself, and not in the disease, which, apparently, had emptied him of every power, mental and physical, except that one fixed idea. I avoided giving Mr. Burns any opening for conversation for the next few days. I merely used to throw him a hasty, cheery word when passing his door. I believe that, if he had had the strength, he would have called out after me more than once. But he hadn't the strength. Ransom, however, observed to me one afternoon that the mate seemed to be picking up wonderfully. Did he talk any nonsense to you of late? I asked casually. No, sir. Ransom was startled by the direct question. But, after a pause, he added equably. He told me this morning, sir, that he was sorry he had to bury our late captain right in the ship's way, as one may say, out of the Gulf. Isn't this nonsense enough for you? I asked, looking confidently at the intelligent, quiet face on which the secret uneasiness in the man's breast had thrown a transparent veil of care. Ransom didn't know. He had not given a thought to the matter. And with a faint smile he flitted away from me on his never-ending duties, with his usual guarded activity. Two more days passed. We had advanced a little way, a very little way, into the larger space of the Gulf of Siam. Seizing eagerly upon the elation of the first command thrown into my lap, by the agency of Captain Giles, I had yet an uneasy feeling that such luck as this has got, perhaps, to be paid for in some way. I had held, professionally, a review of my chances. I was competent enough for that. At least, I thought so. I had a general sense of my preparedness which only a man pursuing a calling he loves can know. That feeling seemed to me the most natural thing in the world. As natural as breathing. I imagined I could not have lived without it. I don't know what I expected. Perhaps nothing else than that special intensity of existence which is the quintessence of youthful aspirations. Whatever I expected, I did not expect to be beset by hurricanes. I knew better than that. In the Gulf of Siam there are no hurricanes. But neither did I expect to find myself bound hand and foot to the hopeless extent which was revealed to me as the days went on. Not that the evil spell held us all was motionless. Mysterious currents drifted us here and there, with a stealthy power made manifest only by the changing vistas of the islands fringing the east shore of the Gulf. And there were winds too, fitful and deceitful. They raised hopes only to dash them into the bitterest disappointment, promises of advance ending in lost ground, expiring in sighs, dying into dumb stillness in which the currents had it all their own way, their own inimical way. The island of Koh Ring, a great, black, upheaved ridge amongst a lot of tiny islets, lying upon the glassy water like a triton amongst minnows, seemed to be the center of the fatal circle. It seemed impossible to get away from it. Day after day it remained in sight. More than once, in a favorable breeze, I would take its bearings in the fast-ebbing twilight, thinking that it was for the last time. Vain hope. A night of fitful airs would undo the gains of temporary favor, and the rising sun would throw out the black relief of Koh Ring. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.